This is The Conversation. It's episode 163 with David Prince, Los Angeles based artist, gallerist, and private school art teacher. Los Angeles back in the house, finally. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can go and check out images of adjunct positions, the Highland Park artist-run gallery that David Prince runs out of his garage and home in Highland Park, and images of his work as well, and the community around adjunct positions there as well. And speaking of community, as you have noticed, I am excited, relieved, apologetic about finally putting out an episode with a Los Angeles-based guest. It has been since mid-July. We are now in late October, so that's a full season since I've had a Los Angeles-based guest. This is a Los Angeles-based show, at least to the extent that that's where I am. Of course, it's a show of the world, a show of the cyberspace, as much it is as a show in Los Angeles, isn't it, ultimately? But in any case, the last guest that was Los Angeles-based is, funny enough, Alicia Eller, the writer Alicia Eller, who happens to live in David Prince's house. So let's expand our community just a little bit. It's good. It's coming around. And by the way, all things going according to plan, a soon-to-come episode is with another LA-based character, and not only that, but we recorded in person. So, double mint action coming your way. So, David Prince, Adjunct Positions Gallery, in case you haven't heard of it, is Highland Park, very artist-run, very process-based, and if you're not familiar in LA, he's got a show opening November 12th specifically, which is Masood Kamandi and Tara Kelton, the latter of whom is based in India, if I remember right, and Masood is local. So FYI, if you want to go check it out and support that gallery and scene, and we talk a lot about both of those things quite a bit, as well as his various experiences throughout the art world and throughout different towns. He was grad school in Chicago, lived in New York, actually grew up in Pasadena, and now is back there. So it's all kind of come full circle. I have some great bad advice for you on the back end. And yeah, let's get to that conversation with David Prince. Thank you for your patience in waiting for another Los Angeles guest. And please support him and the Los Angeles community by spreading the word about this episode so lots of people get to listen to it. All right. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you more on the back end. So you are out in Pasadena right now, right?
Yes.
And what?
I work in Pasadena. It's a 4th grade through 12th grade girls' school. Doesn't have any religious affiliation. And it doesn't particularly have a focus, but yeah.
And how long have you been there?
That's a more difficult question. I guess I started like 13 years ago, right after undergrad. I came here to teach as a long-term sub. But then I was directly after that, I went to grad school and I came back in the summers and taught summer school here off and on, but I didn't move back to LA until about 5 years ago, and then I started teaching here again.
Okay.
So, like 8 years of summer school, teaching ceramics, and then, started teaching full-time just 2 years ago, and part-time for the 3 years before that.
Oh, okay. And so what is your full-time title or class or gig there?
Yeah, well, I was just teaching art part-time, and then an opportunity came up to start a maker space at the school. So, the whole STEM thing at the school became a something that this school really wanted to develop. So I was charged with building that lab. So we have 3D printing and all the kind of art and tech stuff, CNC machines and that sort of thing. And then I still teach art classes. So like this year I'm teaching 3D design. And I've taught everything from ceramics to painting to sculpture and a couple of middle school general art classes.
Wow. Did you have all of these things in your toolbox kind of already, or how much of these things have you adapted to?
Definitely all of the 3D design stuff was new to me. The school, I was very fortunate, the school sent me to Art Center to learn a lot of that. So it's been a great opportunity for me to kind of develop my skill set.
Right.
But like ceramics, I was familiar with. My training is in sculpture and ceramics. Painting and drawing is new to me. And I sort of just filled in for a semester for one upper school class for a teacher. And then I've taught painting and drawing to middle school classes. But I don't know. I think it's interesting for an artist who's trained in, you know, a different medium kind of brings a new perspective. And I think, you know, most of us have had a art foundations course at some point in school. So I think at the high school and middle school level, you can lean more on your general experience, I think.
So you teach kids from like sixth grade to 12th grade, or what's the range?
Well, in the makerspace, it's 4th grade through 12th grade, but in art classes, right now, I just teach upper school, so that's...
I think that makerspace term is something that I've heard, and I'm sure some people listening are familiar with, but maybe you could elaborate just briefly on what that is.
it's kind of for lack of a better word that we use that, but I honestly don't... I think the movement came out of, like, San Francisco, the Make magazine, and the Maker movement. It's sort of like a... I think before that it was kind of DIY culture. But the concept of... I mean, I talk to my students about... It's not just about making things, but kind of understanding how all the stuff around us is put together. So... Mm-hmm. So that they have an idea that everything that we interact with that was made, somebody designed and could be designed differently. And so we take things apart in the classes and kind of learn about how they're put together and then what decision. A lot of it's like thinking about what decisions the maker, you know, made in the first place and how we might do that differently.
The way you describe it, though, it sounds like it's a more common core art curriculum type of thing at private schools or something like that?
It's definitely becoming that. And I think it's been just the last 5 years where, like, everybody has to have a makerspace. And I think part of that is actually there's all these computer labs on campuses that were built in the 90s or early 2000s, and they're becoming obsolete because everybody's switching to laptops. So
right.
Like our school is switching to they call it a one-to-one program where every student has a laptop. You know, even like LA public schools tried out the iPad thing. So I think that's the direction that schools are going. And so these spaces are opening up where they don't need a huge bank of computers. It's kind of a waste of money. So
right.
That's where that's kind of been repurposed.
Right. This is probably going to sound a little blunt, but what is tuition for students to go to the school?
I couldn't tell you exactly. I think it's around $30,000.
Okay.
So
what is
a cheap school? It's around the average for private schools in
right,
the area.
Right.
And I heard somewhere, I think Pasadena has one of the highest private schools per capita in the nation, which is interesting. I don't know exactly what forces are at play that have made that the case.
Right.
So I grew up in Pasadena till about first grade and went to private school in first grade. And then my family moved to South Pasadena because the public school system there is pretty good. So,
right.
So now I'm back in Pasadena, which is a little bit funny for me.
It's
been funny to move back to Los Angeles and back to this place where I grew up, but all of my formal art training happened elsewhere. You know, I went to undergrad in Colorado and then grad school in Chicago. And,
right.
I mean, part of my whole project at Adjunct Positions, the gallery that I run, is for me, I mean, part of that is just about finding my community. I think so many people develop their network and their community through school and going to school in a place where, you know, they intend to stay or end up staying.
So. Yeah, no, I mean, it's important to note that you live in Highland Park, right? Not in Pasadena, but one can't help but wonder, you know, that you are teaching, your job is a full-time job, is in the place where you grew up. I mean, is there something, what does that feel like? Or is it so different now that it doesn't have that kind of quality that you would think?
Oh, yeah, yes and no. I think, like, I don't have a lot of connections from high school. I think the, right, the handful of friends that I still see that are still in Los Angeles are pretty much all artists. Mm-hmm. And so I've reconnected with them through art means, as opposed to sort of stay. I mean, I graduated high school when Facebook wasn't around and, you know, everybody just kind of disappeared for a while. And then I've reconnected with people mostly through art. But yeah, there's occasionally funny situations where I'll bump into someone in the art world that turns out to be, you know, someone from my past. I met someone from first grade a while back. One of the artists actually that I showed, Jane Chang Mi, we actually went to middle school together and hadn't been in touch. And then, you know, I discovered that she was an artist and really loved her work, so ended up reconnecting that way.
Going back though to is it Westbridge School? Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What? So going back to my question about the tuition, I'm just wondering what that means as far as the student body. You know, I mean, what kinds of things are that one might expect go along with that, and maybe what kinds of things you might be surprised about as far as the student body that you work with?
Yeah, well, for one thing, there's a decent financial aid at the school, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. There's a range of, you know, financial situations in students at the school. Sometimes that can be awkward, but I don't know. My expectations coming into the school teaching, definitely, I don't. There's not a sort of over. The school, for one thing, is fairly progressive in terms of helping students think about how they fit into the larger world and being sort of socially conscious and trying to instill values about participating in a community. You know, both within Westridge and the larger community. So we have this CAP project that the students have to work on through their 4 years of high school, where they develop a outward-facing project that culminates in their senior year that has some sort of service slant to it. So I definitely think maybe I had some expectations that it would be a little more sheltered than it is actually, and mm-hmm. insular, but I think that's been a pleasant surprise that I think the school itself really, I think, sort of tries to promote an awareness of social issues that are going on. So
in other words, the entitled factor is quite low, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely comes up once in a while. I remember overhearing a conversation where, you know, a girl was like talking about, you know, what car she was going to get for her 16th birthday. And she was like trying to decide between a Mercedes and something else, you know, and asked another girl, you know, what kind of car she was going to get. And it was very clear. This other girl was like, you know, maybe my parents will let me drive the Corolla, you know,
right.
Like, and so there, you know, occasionally those kinds of things happen where there's a lack of awareness, but like that was a freshman, and I think by the time most of the students are seniors, they're pretty with it in terms of having understanding entitlement and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. I just, you know, and maybe it's a little sensational of me, but I, you know, I would, as a potential teacher for a fancy private school, one of the first things that would come to mind would, oh, I wonder if I'm going to be getting a load of attitude from some of the students kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's not really been my experience.
Right.
But,
yeah.
I feel like it's a great, the school has a, yeah, just a, it's a good community and kind of has good values overall.
Yeah. So you did mention, and so you started and run adjunct positions, which is your artist-run gallery, and I want to sort of connect, you know, your job and adjunct positions, because one of the thoughts that I had is, while you were involved in adjunct teaching, you know, and maybe you will be again at some point in college, and now, as you shared with me, there is a drop in MFA school enrollment. So I wonder if it's occurred to you that you're in a safer place, and in fact, that's part of the reason why you've committed to being full-time there, or, you know, if it was kind of a combination of things.
When I started teaching again 5 years ago at Westridge, I was adjuncting. So I was adjuncting both at Cal State LA and then at Colorado College in between things. I remember specifically at Colorado College, although this is also true of Cal State LA, that I was taking a pay cut to go teach in both of those places and like took time off of teaching at Westridge. And it was a big dilemma for me because I think on some level, this idea that even adjuncting was going to be, you know, further my art career more in some way, seemed more in line with contemporary art and conversations, and my colleagues and my peers would be closer to, you know, people, artists and people that I was, you know, making work and talking about work in. But in the end, yeah, absolutely. I think it's a stable job, and it's also, you know, it pays better than certainly than adjuncting. And maybe, you know, if you were to compare it to a tenure job, maybe that wouldn't be the case, but those jobs are, you know, like unicorns. So,
right. Yeah.
But in terms of the, yeah, the MFA enrollment and dropping, and I certainly think, you know, the students, well, students at my school that I'm counseling about going to school, I mean, I honestly, and this has nothing to do with, I think, a change in time, but I certainly don't counsel people to go to art school, especially for undergrad, just because I think that a non-art education at times can benefit a young person better than an art education, even if they're going to become an artist.
Right. Right. What about going back to what you're saying about your adjunct teaching and, you know, the sense that it would be more of a conversation and, you know, more contemporary art related than being at the private school. I mean, what did you find that was more of a myth than maybe you had thought it would be?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have a community here of artists. We have a great faculty at the school, and you know, it's like a faculty. You know, when at my high school we had like one art teacher, and it was kind of like, you know, an afterthought for sure in terms of our overall education.
Right.
There were no resources, and you know, here we have a whole department. We have, you know, five. We have four full-time and then two part-time faculty members. So, so yeah, it is a community, and people are pretty engaged and active. Part of it is the students, you know, that, you know, high school students are not typically, you know, asking questions that I haven't heard, you know, many times before. They're just kind of at a different place. Although, you know, to be fair, I think undergrads aren't necessarily asking those questions. I think you kind of have to be teaching grad students before you start finding students that are actually really challenging you in terms of like, oh, I had never thought of that before, or that's a totally new idea.
Right.
But it can happen even in high school, and that especially because of the generation gap, there are things that are on their radar that that maybe weren't on my radar.
Sure.
I mean, I learned a thing or two about Snapchat, and I don't know.
I have a
You know,
question for you, David.
it's I think that I, yeah.
Maybe one of your students would be interested in running the conversation Snapchat. And I actually say that in like 60% seriousness, because I had a high school student in she's in Utah, I believe, who I got connected with through a listener of the show, and she was doing it for a little while, but then she just got too overwhelmed with like college application stuff and whatnot. So I know that that's like high school, right? Isn't that the sort of,
Right.
and maybe just slightly below is like the
Yeah.
perfect demo, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, none of my students are on Facebook. They all seem to create Facebook accounts when they graduate. Because I do think it's one of those things where, you know, you stay in touch that way and
Right.
you know, can continue seeing what people are up to a little more easily. But yeah, definitely Snapchat and Instagram, I think, are the social media of choice
And are
for
you
the new
using
generation.
Snapchat yourself?
I do, yeah. It's kind of funny. I mostly use it with my family. I got my mom on it, and we tried to get my grandma on it, but she has a jitterbug phone, and it doesn't accept that app. So,
Right.
but yeah. I mean, I like Snapchat.
Can you, somebody, close enough to my generation, explain what the lure is of it as opposed to the other apps? The what the pleasure of it is,
Yeah. Oh,
the
yeah.
other apps,
I
yeah.
mean, I think it's pretty on a very basic level. It's like an anti-social media in the sense of all the, like the posturing that happens through presenting yourself carefully in Facebook and, you know, curating what you're showing and talking about there because of the sort of the short-lived quality of sending somebody a Snapchat. I guess it's just it's. You just don't put the time and thought into it, and that way it's sort of freeing in that you're not composing a carefully, developed persona. You're just kind of sharing some silly thing, and there's not like public comments on it. It's just so much more informal. So I think that's what appeals to, especially I think to students who feel like so much of what they're doing is. You know, visible and being, you know, all the other social media is, it's a record, you know, and it's interesting actually at the school that most of our major discipline situations over the last 5 years since I've been back here have mostly involved social media. Somebody saying something inappropriate or, bullying or something, but it's all been through stuff happening on social media. So it's, I think it's a difficult place. I don't envy this generation trying to navigate that. And
Yeah.
the thing is, I don't think that adults are very much help. I think we try our best to kind of instill the same kinds of values that we expect in, IRL. But I think it's just really hard to know exactly what it's like to have so much of your life happen in that mediated space.
Right. I take it it's there hasn't been much. There's just been a couple of things, the couple
Yeah, I
of
think we've had like
issues.
two or three in 5 years that
Oh,
were
wow.
cases that sort of
Right.
made their way to the administration and, something had to happen about it.
Right, I see. So adjunct positions. I'm sorry, I did have kind of a train of thought that I was on when we were sort of before we got to that point, and I'm trying to get back to it. What were we talking about before we landed on Snapchat? I think it had to do with,
Well, I guess, yeah, I guess the kind of, for me, adjunct positions, I mean, for me as an artist, it definitely serves a number of purposes. I don't think I'm doing it exclusively to benefit my own art career by any means, but I like I said, I'm sort of, I feel like an outsider to LA, the LA art scene to some degrees. I feel that less so now, but certainly coming back from, I moved back here from New York with very few connections. It was a little bit before. Now there's just so many people migrating both from Chicago and New York to LA. So I think it's gotten easier because many of my friends from those places have been, you know, moving to Los Angeles. So that community is sort of being established regardless of me or adjunct positions. But I do think it started to some degree as a way for me to develop the kinds of relationships and conversations that I didn't have naturally, not having gone to art school in the Los Angeles area.
Right.
So, it fills in. And, you know, and like my school community here at Westridge comes to a lot of the openings. So mm-hmm. there's definitely some crossover. I've had a few students come. I don't generally advertise it to my students, but I actually have a student that lives on my street. So
mm-hmm.
They always know about the openings. But yeah, I think for me, it's definitely allowed those more complex conversations to
right,
continue.
Right. I remember the thing that I wanted to ask you just about your adjunct teaching, such as it is or was, because it always is curious to me when people get into teaching, especially ever more so these days. It's kind of analogous to the unicorn of the the tenured college teaching job is becoming more comparable to just getting good adjunct teaching jobs, right? Reputable art schools or universities. So you mentioned Cal State LA and Colorado College, was it?
Yep.
And so my question is, were you going to school at Colorado College, and that is that what led to you teaching there?
Yeah. I kind of stayed in touch with one of my professors there, and over time, I had actually been back there quite a few times to teach workshops and so forth, and then they invited me to teach a full class.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cal State LA was, just through a friend that was actually knew a number of people teaching there, and ended up teaching there. And I spent about 2.5 years doing residencies in between New York and moving to Los Angeles. And so I was doing a lot of like visiting artist gigs, so not necessarily teaching a full course, but going to school, teaching a workshop. I went to Kansas City Art Institute, to Penn State. I went to Otis College. I had a particular project that was involved making bioplastic and teaching students how to make their own bioplastic that I sort of shopped around and took to different schools.
I see. So you had a very specific niche that you pitched to these places. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into bioplastic?
Not all of them were like that.
Right. But how did you get into
bioplastic? Some of them were just like a connection that I had at those schools.
Right.
I mean, that's been one thing is, one of the pluses, I guess, of having so many adjuncts out there is that you kind of have this network of people in schools. I mean, I have friends at schools like probably,
I'm sorry, you cut off for a second there. In half
of the states in the country,
okay,
I probably
thanks.
Have a friend teaching at some school or another,
right.
And that's a network, that actually I leaned on a bit when I was doing the residency thing. So in between residencies, and some of them were, an exhibition at a school. I did quite a few of those, or just like a visitor gig. But
right.
But at the same time, it's like how many of the? I mean, I got a little bit of money and it pads my resume, I guess. But
yeah.
It's not necessarily like you said. I sort of stopped the search for an adjunct teaching job that would lead to a career kind of job.
Right.
And so if I'm not really looking for that, then those connections, they may not have even helped in the first place anyway. So,
right.
And a lot of those friends, had to make decisions, do I move to Nashville? I have friends in New York that moved to Wisconsin, Nashville, Michigan, places and towns where they certainly wouldn't have chosen just on their own.
Sure. Where did you go to grad school in New York?
To grad school?
Yeah.
I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, SAIC.
So you went to grad school in Chicago. I thought I heard you mention you were in school in New York. That was just where you went after Chicago?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, I moved there with a bunch of friends from grad school in Chicago. We all moved together to New York.
Right. Okay. So the reason I wanted to get sort of to that part of the arc is because I was wondering why you left New York back to California.
I don't know if I have a short answer for that. I think I could have stayed there. I never felt like it was a place where I was going to stay forever. It never felt like that kind of place for me. I was there about 2.5 years. The instigation was I had a business partner, one of my friends from grad school, and we set up sort of a like furniture slash interior design business in addition to many other jobs. I had a lot of the typical art jobs. I did art handling and some art packing and worked for some nonprofit organizations. But that partner who we kind of had been working together, he actually left for an adjunct teaching job in Florida. And so I sort of just, at that point, I could have carried on myself. And I got a residency and really like that actually put everything. Oh, I also lost my apartment. It was like a loft situation. And they sold the building and we're turning it into condos as they do in Williamsburg. And so I lost my space. This all happened at the same time. My business partner left and I got this residency and I put everything in storage and actually everything was all of my belongings that weren't in my van were just in storage in Brooklyn for 2 years as I did residencies. I just didn't move back then basically. You know, I eventually cleared out my storage unit and I moved directly from a residency back to Los Angeles. I think I was in the Netherlands when I got an email from the school, from Westridge, asking if I could come back and teach. So I got a ticket and flew back here. So
when you left New York, you basically did 2 years worth of residencies.
Yeah, it was never like I'm leaving New York. It was kind of like my stuff is in storage. I might move back there. But yeah, I basically then was on the road more or less for about 2 years.
Right. And then when you got the call and you were like, I'm taking that job, and then you started that job and New York was sort of now out of the picture.
Yep.
Right. Got it.
Yeah. I think I, at that point, had already cleared out my storage unit though.
What would you say of the percentage of people from your class or just that you knew from grad school who went to New York with you or, you know, around the same time as you stayed there?
I would say, if I had to estimate, maybe like 50% moved to New York, maybe less than that, let's say 30%. And I'd say over half of those people are still there. Some of them actually came after I left. A few of my good friends stayed in Chicago, sort of established themselves there, and some of them did really well in Chicago and sort of hit a ceiling in Chicago, and then moved to New York. Which that's another interesting thing. I think it's, you know, I've seen friends move cities and how difficult it is to translate success from one city to another. You know, even if you have gallery representation and a good job, you know, a faculty job or something, that doesn't necessarily translate. You kind of have to start over again if you move to a new city,
right.
Which I don't think is so much the case in other careers. You kind of can lean more on your experience.
Yeah, sure. So how much, I was just going to say, so after you moved back, as it were, to LA and you had the teaching job, how long were you in town before you hatched the artist run space?
So that was 3 years ago I started it. So I was here for 2 years, but I knew immediately I've always kind of known I wanted to do an artist run space. It was just kind of a matter of everything falling in line. So my sister and I bought our house in Highland Park, I think actually we just had our 5-year anniversary, so 5 years ago, in October. And I was definitely looking at houses that had a street-facing garage for the ease of converting to a gallery space. So I kind of like had that. I knew that was something that I wanted to work toward, from even before moving to Los Angeles.
How were you able to buy
So
the house?
I mean, we were really lucky in timing. I had been looking at properties, in like in Chicago, in when I was on residencies. I looked at some places with a bunch of friends in New York. But between my sister and I and a loan from my parents, we were able to buy it for pretty cheap, especially compared to today's prices.
Yeah, you got in just in time, didn't you? More or less.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, it was just finding a place. I mean, a lot of people I knew, kind of, especially artists, were in that neighborhood trying to buy houses, and it was really challenging to actually buy something because there were so many contractors kind of swooping in and paying cash, and so we had to overbid quite a bit to get our house,
Wow.
because we knew there was a good chance there would be, cash offers, because there was so much flipping going on. But yeah, I feel incredibly privileged to have that, and I don't think. I certainly wouldn't be running a space if I wasn't fortunate enough to own the house because of like I didn't want to end up in a situation where I was paying rent on a space, and I mean I'm still paying a mortgage, but I'm not paying, my garage is only worth a parking space otherwise, so I don't have that pressure of a lot of artists run spaces that kind of have a good start, and then it's hard to sustain the energy that it takes when you constantly have the financial pressure of paying rent, and just trying to make it all work. So I think that's been a goal of mine from the beginning is to make sure it kind of just fit sustainably into my life. So I think I've been pretty lucky about that.
And did you decide pretty much from the beginning that it was going to be non-commercial?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I fully support artists making money on their work, and I'm happy to facilitate sales, but I was not interested in getting into the business of selling work. It does still take money to run, even though I don't have, rent to pay. There's definitely still costs associated with it, and that just kind of comes out of my pocket. And honestly, I probably couldn't do that if I didn't have the, like you said, the job that I have that's stable and reliable, and I'm not doing as much hustling and driving all over the city for work. So, I'm close enough I can ride my bike to work. So that's kind of lined up nicely and allowed me the ability to put extra time into the gallery. Although I have to say another drawback of the kind of teaching job that I have is that there's a different expectation between what a college or a university expects and supports from their faculty and a high school. So I'm supported certainly by my school for some professional development, but at most universities, it's really what you do with your art career outside of the school is really encouraged. And in fact, I mean, sometimes your job kind of relies on you making steps forward in your career outside of the school. Whereas, really the focus at a high school is the students and really being a good teacher. So which kind of means that there's less of that, oh, I need to leave for a month to go, put on an exhibition in Florida or whatever. Those conversations there, and there is like some support at my school, but it's just not the norm. There aren't like teachers constantly going off and doing their own projects, and that's not that it's discouraged, but it's not part of the culture. So You know, and I've been appreciative of how much support there has been at the school. They've given me some professional development, even to like I had full rein of the ceramic studio 2 years ago to put together a body of work that I showed in an exhibition in Idaho the following year. And so, you know, it's not that they haven't been supportive, but it's just a different culture. So I think that's just one of the give and takes
Right.
of you know, working in a school. Also just the resources. You know, we have some good resources at the school. They're way better than my public school. You know, we have a wood shop, and we have like I said, all the 3D printing and CNC stuff, but it's not like I have, you know, an amazing lab the way that my, like, you know, my graduate program had or something. So
I want to go back to the gallery and what I was wondering when you were talking about your decision of how you were going to run it is if you're having a show. We should make clear though that first of all that the people who show there, if they manage to get sales, you know, they keep those sales, right? I mean,
They
does
have,
that happen
yeah,
like
full.
5% of the time, or is it much higher percentage than that, would you say?
I
No
couldn't even point
idea.
to like a sale. I think I've put somebody in touch with somebody once, who was interested in a work, but I'm not even sure what happened with that sale.
I
So
see.
I, and you know, there's, I try to contribute. I think we try to split installation costs and so forth, with the gallery, shipping costs, although I don't have a ton of shipping costs, because I mostly am showing Los Angeles based artists. I've shown a few artists from out of town.
And you've covered their costs
But
when you
yeah,
did?
no, we usually roughly split the costs for installation, or like if, you know, let's say someone's, if there's something needed, like a projector or a monitor, I try to do those things, and then, you know, keep it for the gallery. So
Well,
yeah,
that's a
I try to
really
help as much as I can, but I
sure.
think artists go into it knowing what kind of space it is. I always talk to them about, you know, that if they are able to sell something, that they can, you know, they get 100% of sales, and that I'll, you know, I'll support them as best I can to make the work happen. It's very much a conversation, like what work they're going to show and how they're going to install it and all that. Because I've had artists show kind of all over the house, not just, you know, I have kind of an official gallery space both in the garage and in the living room, but I've had artists show in the back patio and like all over the face of the house. And so that, how that kind of happens is, it's less like they walk into the gallery with a body of work that they're going to exhibit.
I empathize with you that you get to, for the most part, split the costs of the installation with the artists who are showing. I guess it's you would also have to wonder, playing devil's advocate, if you're an artist, especially, well, not necessarily, well, but probably, especially an artist out of the area and maybe even out of the country, because I imagine you have done that. But just what, you know, would propel somebody to pony up for that kind of shipping cost. If it's because of it's such a great opportunity, it's because you know them and you know they want to kind of meet you halfway, or is what is it?
Well, we haven't. I haven't had. So my first artist, Tara Kelton, is coming from India. That's the next show opening. But that's she's the first artist I've had out of the country. And previous to that, I had an artist from San Francisco, who has family in Pasadena, and so she. It was easy for her to travel anyway, and I want to be careful, but I don't think there are any other artists. I think all other artists have been Los Angeles based, and I mean, part of that is for that reason. You know, it's just, it is really hard to show work from artists from other places because of shipping costs. It's because it's really expensive to ship art, but you know, also I want to support the LA community, so that is just sort of part of the mission of the space is you know, being a part and a resource for LA artists specifically. But also for me, building the audience of the gallery also works better with LA artists, because
sure.
I sort of you know, my network and their network combine to make a, you know, a successful showing of the work. So and then you know, it expands my network, and
right.
You know, I feel like even though I've been around for 3 years, it's still like a young space, so we're still establishing our network, and like I said, I didn't have a network coming into it, so that's been a way for me both to expand my network for the gallery and also to keep costs down for shipping, and to really serve the local community.
Right. Yeah, and I'm glad you used that word, because that was going to be the next thing I wanted to talk about, community. Because the thing that I was thinking, and because you've talked to me in the past about, you know, the importance of community to you and the particular community that is connected with the gallery as distinct from, you know, a more commercial type community scene or gallery scene. And the first thing that comes to mind is if you're having shows for about 3 or 4 times a year, that's a pretty big gap between shows as far as the community. So I guess to put maybe a specific question on it, does that mean, have you found in these 3 short years that what you build with the shows and the openings sort of plays out between shows, you know, in a sense?
I don't know if I know exactly what that means.
I can clarify that.
Yeah.
What I mean is that if you have an opening, you know, and then you don't have another opening for 4 months, let's say, or 3 months, you know, the community, the opportunity for community building in an in-person sense is limited because, you know, it's only so frequent. So what I was asking is, so is there some kind of community that is continuing to build in between those times?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, so this, like, it's not like this, like an artist run space. Like I'm the first person to make an artist run space. I mean, there's like gotta be, you know, 100 of them in Los Angeles. So, I don't think people even notice, you know, if I don't do a show every, 2 months, cause there's so many things going on. And, you know, a lot of, I have so much respect for, so many artist run spaces in Los Angeles, and it is a lot of overlapping community. So, you know, when I go out to openings, I'm seeing the same people. I'm seeing artists that I've shown at my gallery. I'm going out to support their shows at other spaces. So, you know, I don't feel like it has to be, you know, me creating this, this community. I mean, the community exists there already. For me, it's a way to tap into it and then support it.
Right.
So,
right. I see. Yeah. Do you feel like, you know,
yeah.
that raises an interesting, maybe paradox. We'll see if it is or not, but you just described a community, you know, across a hybrid community of different, like, you know, alternative galleries, artist-run galleries, artists, and so on, you know, that you're running into, right? Does it feel, so the first question is, does it feel like it's a pretty tight-knit, you know, you see a lot of the same people, and you know, around kind of thing, or does it not necessarily feel like that?
I think more and more so it feels more tight-knit. I think
right.
it's taken me a while to work my way into that community. But yeah, definitely see the same people. You know, even people I don't know, I know so many people just by sight
sure.
that I see at so many of the openings. A friend of mine, Sarah Schnatt, who she and I actually ran this, we co-ran the space for about a year before she moved to San Francisco. But she moved to San Francisco for a tech job. She's also an artist, but she works in data visualization, and she had this project that never quite got off the ground of creating a data visualization map of kind of connecting all the different art organizations and people in Los Angeles and kind of creating this visual web, which, you know, relates to a lot of the other work that she does. But yeah, at any given, I mean, I definitely think the artist-run community is a tight community, and they support each other. I've met a lot of the artists that run other spaces have just, you know, showed up at my openings and introduced themselves, and you know, and some organizations have, like, you know, human resources put on like a mixer for artist-run spaces. I think they had like 20 artist-run spaces where everybody presented kind of what they do. And so I definitely think there's, you know, a lot of, you know, individuals and small organizations that are working toward the same goal of just trying to support art in Los Angeles.
Right. Right.
You know, outside of a commercial.
Right.
Venue. Although, you know, I see those same people at the commercial gallery openings as well.
Yeah. So, see, the point that I'm trying to make from what you're describing is that the picture you're painting is a relatively small-ish community considering Los Angeles. You know, I mean, you're seeing a lot of the same people, certainly at the artist-run openings, and then you're even seeing some crossover at the commercial openings, which, you know, that's not a newsflash by any stretch. I'm not trying to make any breaking news here. I'm just trying to identify something. And the sort of paradox that I was going to get to is when you were talking earlier about all of the people who are migrating here to Los Angeles. To me, whenever I hear about migrations, you know, big Los Angeles migrations, especially, which have been happening, what, in the last, you know, since you're like on the front lines of that whole migration, right? In the last three or 4 years, it always feels like, Jesus, I mean, there's just not enough room for all of us. You know what I mean?
Right.
There are only so many spaces, including artist run spaces. So what you're doing is fantastic, you know, in that end. But it's like the more people that keep moving here, you know, it's like the scene just it continually overflows. You know, it's like a pool that continues to overflow with water, and continue that metaphor however you like, but that's basically what I was getting at.
Yeah, I do, and I do think it's like it's just a paradox, because I was talking with a friend about the idea that there's no such thing as a job as an artist. Like, you don't, you know, you can be an artist and you can make money doing it. You know, if you're successful and you get represented by a gallery or fortunate enough just to have people buy your work. But it's not like the something where you go out and get a job. And I think there's like I think artists have all, I mean, that there's always been a case where, like, there's this scarcity of opportunities, and there is kind of like a sense of competition, and, like, you know, it's honestly, it can be really disheartening to see, you know, some of the artists who are, like, so brilliant and talented, you know, put a lot of work into a show, and then, you know, the most I can do is help them put the show on, but I can't guarantee that it's going to lead to, you know, some other success. You know, I do my best to myself, like, promote the show, and you know, maybe they get something written up. But I totally agree that it's like it's not an easy thing to be, like, hustling as an artist, you know, and I think I could say, you know, all of the artists that have shown at adjunct positions in one way or another are kind of like doing some kind of hustle. I think shortly after her show, Carol Frances Leung ended up with a tenure job at Cal State. So, you know, good for her.
Wow.
But you know, it's definitely, oh, and I think my next, Masood Kamandi, not sure. I know he teaches at PCC, and I think he may, I shouldn't say that. I'm not sure if he has a tenure job or not, but I think he's full-time there now. So, yeah, I agree that it's something that I don't think it's new or specific to LA. I mean, that was the case when I was in New York as well, that there was this oversaturation, you know, and this is like, you know, the thing of MFA enrollments are going down, and I think there's an awareness from a younger generation that, or there's at least a higher focus on practical jobs. I think even, you know, I've talked to some faculty who are teaching undergrad about whether the kinds of conversations that they have about art have changed. And I think, you know, just anecdotally, there's people have told me that there's the students themselves are sort of pushing toward more practical questions about making work and like pushing toward more practical career decisions than certainly I think when I was in school, and like we didn't talk at all about you know, how you were going to make a living.
Right.
I think, you know, Karen Atkinson kind of started that conversation in LA. I don't know if you know her. She's at CalArts. She has this whole get your shit together thing.
Yes, I've gotten her emails. Yes. Have you taken the class or do you know
anyone else? Yeah. Yeah. You know, she has this whole like idea about, you know, the horizontal career of the artist versus the vertical career of the artist. And I think there's a lot of truth to it, but I think that it's not easy. I mean, it's certainly like that horizontal career where you might be, you know, adjuncting a class, you might be running a shop, you might be a receptionist somewhere, you might, you know, have any number of jobs that are peripheral to art and might even inform your art, but it's certainly not easy.
Yeah.
So
do you, as the gallerists, get looked to for advice or wisdom to any degree since in these 3 years that you've been doing this?
Yeah. You mean with the artists that are showing?
Sure.
Or in general?
Sure. With the artists.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like I try as much as possible for, I think I said this to you before, but I'm more interested in showing artists than showing work, just in the sense that, you know, I'll start a conversation with an artist and get to know them and do studio visits and all the regular things. But what ultimately like results in a show at my gallery isn't that like I love a particular piece of work, but that
right.
I'm interested in what the artist has to say and how they talk about their work and maybe even like some of their own history, how they came to art and why they do it, is more interesting to me than
sure
than the work itself. So I guess in that sense, like I definitely have had plenty of conversations about like what work is going to go into the show, because that's not just a top down, you know, I like this piece and this piece and this piece and, you know, there's our show. I like it when an artist can make new work and take some risks. So there's definitely a fair amount of back and forth. I don't know if I want or have any authority over what should or shouldn't be shown, but I've had some like challenging conversations with friends who maybe think that they should have a show at the gallery, and
let's stop on that point, David, because that's like a great nugget of dynamics because I mean it could trigger so many different questions from my memory. The first one that actually it kind of oddly dovetails to is the one when you have a friend, let's say, you know, an acquaintance or friend, and you've seen their work and you really don't like it. Like maybe, I mean, this happened to me many years ago. I became friends with this artist and I hadn't seen his work. And then I saw his work and I was like, eh. But you know, I liked him as a person, you know, so it's kind of that same kind of dynamic. It's like, you really have to walk the tightrope. You know, you want to be supportive to this person you're talking about, or these artist friends that you have, but you got to ultimately make it clear to them that you've got a pretty full plate as far as your program, right?
Yeah. And that like, you know, their work may just not fit into my vision for the space, which doesn't mean they're necessarily making bad work, although I mean I have like very particular things that I really like to show,
right? And these
like
people,
I said, kinds of artists.
Yeah. And these people that you're referring to, they maybe aren't doing enough of their homework to not sort of realize that.
Right. Yeah. And I certainly get tons of, I mean, that's just friends, but I get a lot of emails that are sort of shot in the dark emails about, you know, showing something or other at the space.
Right. Sure.
Which I usually don't even finish reading unless, you know, if someone, you know, wants to start a conversation like, oh, you would, do you want to do a studio visit or can you come see this other show I'm doing? You know, I am more than happy to start a conversation, but, yeah, I think it's kind of like when people have an idea already and they're just being around for a space, it's just, you know, not as interesting to me to just kind of facilitate an idea. I like it to be a process. So, and, you know, I guess I'm privileged to have that right to pick and choose how I want to go about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing that. Yeah. I had a friend of mine along the same lines of this topic, was saying how there's nothing, that feels dirtier than, hooking up with somebody that you don't like their artwork. And I think that like it's challenging for sure when you you know, especially if you like a person and then yeah, like you said, you come across their work and you don't have the same respect for it. It changes the relationship. I don't know if there's like if that's just like an art world thing. I imagine that happens in writing and other disciplines.
Right, sure. I found that I've been getting a lot more critical in the last couple years, and I had the conversations with an artist or two several years ago who, and they were really critical. You know, they sort of like, ah, that's crap. You know, that kind of conversation, and you're kind of like, whoa, you know. And I find that I've kind of gone more in that direction, and I wonder, you know, if that's something you can kind of relate to. I mean, you made it clear that you have a particular type of not only art, but sort of process that, you know, is your thing. And do you find that even if you are, you know, going to shows of other alternative galleries, artist-run galleries, you know, to be supportive and, you know, be part of the community and that kind of thing, that it's maybe not to your taste a lot of the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've established different levels of like critique and in that, you know, there's like the level of like, is this something I'm interested in learning more about for, you know, for the sake of my gallery and just like I'm interested in the work. But then there's like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think I'll ask the question like, should this thing be like in the world? You know, is there an audience for it that it's benefiting? I don't feel like every piece of artwork certainly has to like be for me or for my tastes.
Right.
You know, there's some work out there that probably the world would not lose anything by not having in existence. And yeah, I do think that kind of work I'm more critical of, although some of that has to do with, for me, like, is I'm more critical of more successful artists in that way, where I'm kind of like, you know, an artist who's had things and then they're making work that I feel like is really not benefiting really any conversation. Then I think that's where I end up being more critical.
Sure.
Or when like an institution, you know, you know, a museum like the Hammer Museum or I just brought them up because I feel like they're somewhat of a bridge organization between kind of smaller galleries and larger museums and in the kind of work they show. But, you know, sometimes they'll show somebody and you're like, really, is this the thing that is most worth like people seeing?
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
not that the artist like shouldn't have made it, but you know, I think that once you get into all the power dynamics of larger institutions, then I think there is much more pressure to be showing work that is important to an audience as opposed to an individual, like, you know, in my case. So.
Right. Well, going back to what you were talking about with, the artist not being a job, but being sort of a life, and that you do other mm-hmm. things along the way. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, and people, in, you know, at the school you teach, as well as artists that you're talking to, you know, talking a lot about what their job life is and is going to be like. It made me think that what you have, you know, going back to the beginning, you know, a full-time job at this private school, it seems a good thing to have, you know, to be able to facilitate all these other things. And I guess I was curious whether you on any level felt a sense of envy from your peers, either, you know, obviously I would imagine not at all on an overt level, but maybe in a very sort of abstract way, you know, just through the context of people's struggles.
Right. Yeah, no, I don't feel like I've felt it at all. I think because of it doesn't have a cachet to it at all. It's
right.
Certainly like high school art teacher is not what most people are shooting for. So, I mean, I kind of feel like I fell into it and mm-hmm. feel really lucky
mm-hmm.
Because I think it took me a while to learn how valuable it was. I mean, maybe I had some sense of it. But I think, you know, when I first started here, I still kind of like had that like, oh, you know, I need to take these adjunct jobs. I need to like have a foot in that other world.
Right.
But yeah, I don't really feel any need anymore to have that. But I don't know that people, interestingly, I have met of artists who teach at other private schools. And I think it's sort of like, yeah, a secret like dream job. you know, teaching art at a private high school.
Well, you know, I think this is just,
you know, they're,
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, this is a brand new status that you have. I mean, for me,
yeah.
because I,
yeah.
this is for me, because you shared that article with me about the decline in MFA enrollment. And then I just had a phone conversation with an artist who has been selling work for 10 years and is asking around about job referrals, you know, or recommendations.
Right.
So to me, this is today, you know, October, late-ish October 2016, that a private school art job is pretty golden all of a sudden.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm curious if it's going to survive the robot apocalypse when, you know, the robots start taking over our jobs. I think uh-huh. education is maybe toward the end of that list, but yeah, I mean, it's funny because there has been so much talk about like which jobs are going to disappear, you know, like the taxi jobs are going to disappear to self-driving cars. And, actually just read recently about, you know, the first sewing machine robot that fully, you know, sewed an entire piece of clothing from start to finish. So I think like, as much as it's like, it's sort of like still feels like pop fiction. I think artists in some ways like are already living in that, in the reality of like what I was saying about art, there are no jobs in the sense of like, no one's going to employ you to make fine art. So we already are kind of finding ways to like make work and value our work, that exist outside of that. But I mean, maybe that's coming for everybody, that they're going to be in, you know, even like, you know, your engineer is in the same boat of like, you know, there's what do I do with my time? How do I make my time important and valuable and contribute to society when there's not like a job for me? So
yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know how far they keep saying that we're, you know, 10 years out from it, but I feel like maybe we finally are getting close to that. So
what is it?
Maybe artists have.
Go ahead.
On that situation.
I was just going to say, what is it in your life in particular that is making the near apocalypse so present, do you think?
I'll avoid politics.
Thank you.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just in terms of the, I don't actually think that we're close to an apocalypse, but I do think the robot thing that
that's
the,
what I meant.
Like,
that's what I meant. The robot apocalypse. Where they
yeah.
take over our jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I do think autonomy is definitely going to change the world pretty dramatically. I think the consequences are more dire for third world or developing countries than they are for wealthier countries, because so many people in those countries rely on the kinds of jobs that can easily be replaced by robots. So I guess I'm a little bit tongue in cheek, and it's
sure.
a little ridiculous to talk about it in an art conversation, but but I do just think it's a funny parallel that artists are sort of already living in that world to some degree, where
right.
where we don't have jobs.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's just, you know, I heard on NPR they were interviewing these Kenyan taxi drivers who all had switched over to Uber. Then there was this there was actually like violence between the taxi drivers and the Uber drivers because you know, vying for sort of control of resources, and how like all of those people being interviewed, you know, in another 5 years, you know, there might be no driver. So I do think like it's definitely like an issue that is going to, you know, but I, it's, you know, they said that in the Industrial Revolution that factories were going to kind of wipe out all the jobs, and they didn't. So
yeah. Well, David, this has been interesting. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to have a break from talking about politics with people.
good.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And we're out. Thank you very much again to David Prince for talking to me. I hope you enjoyed that. And by the way, neither of us thought twice about the fact that we were recording across town in the same city over the phone as opposed to in person. It's just makes more sense practically. Although that said, like I alerted you at the beginning, we will have a live in the room conversation coming up fairly soon. Stay tuned for that. And speaking of community, and speaking of a long time since we had a Los Angeles guest, it's been a long time since I've gotten a new donator to the show. I believe it's been about 2.5-3 weeks. So if you have not donated the conversation, financial donations are extremely appreciated. They keep the show going. This is how the show survives, through your financial donations. And I know, believe me, I am completely empathetic. I have this bill to pay at some point. I have that bill to pay at another point. And do I want to donate to a podcast? How am I going to do that? I get that. But if you are somehow able to squeak out, you know, $10, $15, $20, $30, it would be extremely appreciated. So it really does add up. Thank you very much in advance. Of course, you can also support the show, or just be friendly with the show if you don't like the word support, by following at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and of course, Facebook. Become a fan there. And you can also be very kind and go to the iTunes page for the Conversation, an Artist Podcast, and leave us a nice review. It's always extremely appreciated and helps us find more artist-based or artist-interested listeners, and helps grow the base, which is extremely important, as you've heard. All right, let's get to that bad advice. Bad advice courtesy of Catherine Mitchell out in New Jersey. Thank you, Catherine. I felt so painfully isolated that I vowed I would get revenge on the world by becoming a famous cartoonist. R. Crumb. Okay, that's not really advice, but, you know, it has a sentiment of advice, doesn't it? This is some truly bad advice. It's secret advice to artists from the writer Neil Gaiman. You only need 2 of the following 3 things to get work consistently. Your work must be good, you deliver on time, and you're easy to get along with. Yeah. As if we aren't already doing all of those things, Neil. Thank you very much anyway. And finally, in classic bad advice style, the problem with the world is that the intelligent people are full of doubt while the stupid people are full of confidence. Charles Bukowski. Wow, talking about hitting the nail on the head, eh? So that's it for bad advice. That's it for episode 163. Thank you very much for being here. I hope I'm not sounding overly enthusiastic, but I am glad to have David and a Los Angeles-based guest back on the show, and we will have, like I said, another one very soon. May happen next week, maybe the week after, but either way, it's going to happen soon. Stay tuned. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast, and let us know what you think. However you feel, preferably diplomatically, but, you know, whatever works for you. Thanks so much. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.